Welcome to Still Talking Uncut. I'm your host, Big Easy, joined by co-host, Master Distiller Sean Rixby, who didn't make it to Doug's Jar release. Also joined by, you know, special guest, my man, Uncle Joey. You know, last but not least, the Masters. Welcome to the show back. You know, I love giving the Master shit. We'll go ahead and get right to our special guest, man. We got a special guest from Glens Creek Distilling. Out of Woodford County, Frankfort, Kentucky. Welcome to the show, David. It's a pleasure to have you, sir.
Thank you, guys. Glad to be here.
Welcome.
Absolutely.
Always like hearing you guys that, you know, we hear a lot of backwoods guys talk, so it's always nice to hear somebody in a distillery talk. So we always start the show with what you drinking on. Uncle Joey, I know you got something special over there, baby. What you got?
Well, a gentleman came down to your distillery, and him and his boss were down there on a bourbon trip. We actually talked to him after he'd been to your place, and, man, that was a fun interview. But he had you get
– He was blasted when we had Dan on. Yeah. He woke up from sleeping half of one off. He was lit.
So he grabbed this bottle, and you actually signed this bottle for me, and I appreciate that. It's OCD number 5, and – I had it at Dan's place, and, man, I fell in love with it. I must say, that is a really solid bottle you guys make down there. That's good.
Well, thank you.
And that's, what, 51 months? Is that what it is, at least?
Well, we don't do it based on time. We do it based on taste, so they vary.
Okay, well, this one was 49.
They're all single barrel. Yeah, they're all single barrel.
You don't hear that very often, so that's – nice. That's awesome. Yeah. You know,
and I'm gonna tell you guys what I will bring. I mean, see, these guys, I'm more the bourbon drinker of the group. These guys will drink it, but I'm the kind of one that's shoving the bourbon down these guys. And this is a bottle that I highly recommend. That, you know, it's not too much, it's not too weak, it's right there in the middle, man. It's a really, really solid bottle. I get a lot of flavor, I get a lot of mouthfeel, got a good texture to it. It's a good bottle.
Yeah, well, we got we have tequila and rum too, you know. So
yeah, I saw
the
that.
Others.
I saw that.
Drinking anything over here, Sean?
Yeah, man. Got to go with old Hooch's peach brandy.
It's the only one you could get open. I dig it.
Fuck you guys, man.
Man.
What about you?
Yeah. Corn liquor, Uncle Dum Dums. Clear corn liquor. Straight from the bottle. Not everybody needs a glass, Sean. Mr. David, you drinking on, sipping on anything this evening?
Well, actually, I got a little pear brandy that I distilled many years ago.
Yeah. You're after my heart right there. I love me some brandy, man. Did you age it or did you keep it
clean? Oh yeah. No, it's definitely aged.
That's beautiful. Now, on that pear, after you aged it, did you feel like the pear flavor came out more after it aged?
You know what? I don't remember. It's been a long time.
All right.
this is one I've had here at the house and just haven't tapped into lately, and thought for a special occasion I'd go ahead and give it a try.
Well, appreciate that.
Yeah, we appreciate you breaking that out for us. Yeah, these guys are big brandy lovers, so when you said brandy, it actually, all of us, it kind of, I was like, uh-oh, this guy likes brandy, so this is going to be an interesting avenue to go down. Is pear one of your favorite brandies, or do you have a favorite?
You know, a neighbor of mine says to me, hey, I got a bumper crop of pears. You want some?
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, sure. I guess I'll see what I can do with them.
I never say no to free fruit.
This might have been before I got legal.
Nice.
So
nice.
Maybe. I'm just saying, might have been. So
allegedly.
Allegedly, that was 10, 11 years ago.
All right, so we got somebody wanting to, they're intrigued about your tequila process, what type of agave you use, you know, what type of process you use for fermenting and distilling, and do you age it?
Yeah, so we get agave syrup from Mexico. Obviously, agave doesn't grow much in Kentucky.
Yeah.
So we get the syrup. We get the syrup from Mexico, and then we ferment it and distill it pretty much the same way we do all the other stuff, the bourbons and so forth. We can get into the distillation, but then we have the three different grades. So, you know, Blanco is not aged, Reposado is traditionally 6 to 12 months, and then Añejo is 12 plus months. And so we've got, that's a hard one to keep in stock because of the, you know, those aging limitations. So if I distill it, put it in a barrel, and then it goes, you know, 8 months, well, that's going to be a Reposado. But if it goes 13 months, then it's, you know, technically going to be Añejo. So we don't always have all of those in stock. It just depends on, you know, and I don't distill tequila year round. It's more, usually I try to do it in the summertime. So,
before we get too far ahead of ourselves, tell us how you got into this. You know, I mean,
childhood thing, family tradition, something you picked up as a kid, you know.
No.
Listen, I did my homework. This is an interesting story, man. So please continue.
Well, you know, life can be funny sometimes where it takes you unexpectedly. So in 2009, one of my colleagues asked if I could build him a still, which I thought was rather unusual given that my knowledge of distilling was absolutely zero at that point. And look, I got to go back because my knowledge of alcohol at that point was damn near zero. You know, I came to Kentucky. I grew up in South Florida. I came here in 1980. I went to a distillery in 1999, and that was the only distillery I'd ever been to. So I really didn't know anything about distilling or the industry or any of it. But I knew how to TIG weld, which was the kind of the key factor. So he had a stainless steel beer keg. He wanted me to turn into a still. So little engineering background. So I did a little, you know, research and figured out, okay, hot stills at their very basics are pretty simple. And so I made him the still, gave it to him, and then the funny thing is I never thought to ask him later if he used it or did he make anything, did it work, you know, any of those kind of things you would think. I just went about my business, and in 2011 I was at his house and I noticed the still was in the garage and he had never used it, so I suggested he give it back to me. And then I had to figure out what to do with it. I didn't, you know, there's a difference between making a still and using a still. Mm-hmm. And so making it was pretty straightforward. So I, you know, started doing some reading, go to Facebook, watch Moonshiner's TV show, whatever I could find out about how to actually distill. And then I reasoned, well, I'm in Kentucky. Maybe I should try to make bourbon. I didn't, you know, he was going to make sugar shine, and somehow that seemed boring. And so I thought, well, I'll try bourbon. The only thing is I didn't know what bourbon was at that time. So mind you, in 2011, I was 53. And probably I'd only had about 5 bourbons ever in my entire life. And probably 95% of the time it was with Coke. So, I mean, I was essentially as novice as you could possibly get. But I thought, you know, people have been distilling for a couple thousand years. Science is you know, relatively recent. You know, how hard can it be if people did this for almost 2,000 years without any scientific understanding? Then it you know, at the most basic level, it can't be that complicated. And so that's kind of how I approached it. And I just started experimenting with different things and trying different things and you know, questioning things. If you read anything, you're going to hear the same kind of things over and over again about, the one main thing was, you don't want to use wild yeast. You'll get off flavors. You know, it's unpredictable. It's blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, the OCD number five, you got there, Uncle Joey. The number five represents the fermenter back in the distillery where we caught yeast that we use to do our fermentation with. And we do a lot of things. I would say we do a lot of things that probably would scare other distillers. You know, we take a most, you know, non-scientific approach to things. We transfer yeast from one batch to the next. We don't buy yeast. We do a lot of things that probably other distillers would look at and think, oh my God, what are these guys doing?
Sounds a lot like home distillers.
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, I learned how to distill in my garage, and so I carried over that same, you know, mindset into
this. We all do that now. We always talk about, man, if we had a distiller, we'd do it just like this still. We would still do it like this.
Hell, you know, I mean, the first time I tasted some of my own distillate, it was a little bit of a surprise. I mean, I'd never had anything directly out of a still before. I'd never had any spirit that didn't come from a column still. I mean, I really had very, very little reference point to anything, you know? And so, but I enjoy experimentation and discovering things like how much difference does the water make? How much difference does the yeast make? How much difference does the mash bill make? You know, these things you hear at other distilleries that they proclaim, you know, are what makes them unique, special, and different. And so I was just having fun. I was just doing a lot of experimentation, trying to find out, you know, so is it really the limestone filtered water in Kentucky? Because, you know, we're probably the only place on the planet that actually has limestone filtered water. I mean, you guys are in Ohio, aren't you? I don't think there's there's no limestone up there. I mean, surely you know there's limestone in Ohio and Michigan and Virginia and West Virginia and Pennsylvania and New York, and damn near everywhere. You know, and so anyway, it was just a big experiment. Really. And then I was also, you know, toying around with the whole question of age. And, you know, on one side of the equation, you'd hear the industry insiders saying you just really can't, you really can't shortcut Mother Nature. And then on the other side, you've got these guys that are saying, oh, well, I can create a 4-year-old product in, you know, 24 hours. And so I wanted to find out, you know, what really is the kind of quote unquote secret of the maturation process, and how long does it really take? And so anyway, this, you know, this went on for a couple of years, and then I was sharing my stuff with my friends just to get their feedback. Never during this time, not one time during this time, did it occur to me to start a distillery. That's kind of interesting. I was just doing this because I was curious. And
yeah, all home distillers go through that. We get started and then we just go through all these things and see what we like, see what works best for us. And And, you know, we try other people's things and do it our way until we find our own way. So it's all part of the process.
Yeah, it is.
So when you were starting out, were you using the different kinds of corn, or were you just using one particular kind of corn, or how did that hold?
Well, that's an interesting question there. So I ran into a guy who made moonshine, and, you know, I was asking him what to do. And he says, well, go to the store and get some Martha White, you know, cornmeal and use that. So I did. I mean, I didn't know any better. And I cooked it and did the whole nine yards. And then when it came time, because as you know, if you're using direct heat, you can't put the grain in the still. So I tried separating that stuff. And I tried everything, man. I tried, you know, pillowcases, socks, cheesecloths. I tried everything to get that shit to separate.
Clumps. And anytime it's real fine, man.
So finally, I just said, screw that. And I went to Tractor Supply and got crack corn. And,
all right, my man.
And that was tried it.
True.
From there. So, but you know, that, people ask me all the time about, you know, trial and error. And I said, look, when you're learning something, you try something. If it doesn't work out, I don't call that an error. I call that learning.
Learning. Yeah, right. And there are no failures. There's just
learning. I've heard all these guys say that. Absolutely.
And if you don't like the way it turned out, try something different, you know, experiment. And that was the fun of it. I never made anything that wasn't drinkable. You know, and some you like better than others, but none of them were god awful horrible, you got to throw it away kind of thing. And if I encountered somebody, you know, I encountered a guy one day, he said, well, you should try Welch's grape juice. I thought, well, I like Welch's grape juice, so I'll try that. So I fermented Welch's grape juice. One lesson I learned there is definitely don't add any sugar water to that after it's fermenting, because it comes out of there like a geyser. grape juice went everywhere. It was quite a mess.
Learning experience.
Yeah. So anyway, this went on and somebody I knew in 2013, he said, hey, I know real cool old distilleries for sale. And I was intrigued at that point. And when you do a little research on Old Crow, the history of the brand, the place, the person, you know, Dr. James Crow, that's when it became, you know, an idea to start a distillery. And you know, my past career, I was a consultant for 25 years and worked with organizations and did a lot of planning and preparation type activities. So, you know, I knew going into it, when I made a business plan, if you're going to do a smart business plan, you better underestimate your revenue and overestimate your expenses, and, you know, plan for things aren't going to work out, and you know, so on and so forth. But of course, when you're planning into the future, there's always things you can't anticipate. You just don't know, and that's all part of it. So I put together a business plan and started calling banks to see whether, you know, they would lend me some money. And bankers are kind of funny. They tend to be risk averse, and they don't want to lose the bank's money. So, you know, you go in and start talking to them, and they start asking the questions like you did, Big Easy. So, was it in your family? Did you work at another distillery? Was it a lifelong passion? You know, and you just say, well, no. And then you can see them, you know, preparing how they're going to tell you no. And so I got turned down a lot of times. And you'd have to see the condition of the property too. So you show them, hey, here's the place I want to buy, and it's been abandoned for 30 years, and it's in pretty rough shape, and so all those things, you know, they just aren't inclined to lend you the money, and so
deck's always stacked against you, so you just gotta make your own luck sometimes.
Well, and they got a lot of competition down there too, so
yeah.
Also,
so I was watching a video earlier, and you were filling a 300 gallon tote. So basically, what you were doing, you were pouring used still beer into the tote when you were, you know, remashing in, and then you were adding the rest from there. Explain to people essentially why you were doing that.
Well, I'm not sure what you're talking about.
Was you making a sour mash?
Yeah,
he was using the
sour mash.
Okay,
reusing your back set to make a sour mash.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so you saw the video where I was emptying the quote what we call the cooker. You know, you other people call it a mash tun or something like that. We just call it a cooker. Into the IBC totes that we use for fermentation. So we like a lot of distilleries, probably we have our own terminology, and we just say, look, we're going to drop the cook. Okay. So we call it the cook. The cook is you fill it up with X amount of water. You heat that water to boiling and you add the corn, and then you let that sit until usually about an hour and a half. We turn off the heat and let it cool down. Once it reaches the certain temperature, then we drop the cook, and at that point we add either the rye or the wheat, depending on what recipe we're making, and then we let it cool down some more till it gets to the barley temperature, and but we put the setback in there when we first drop it. So that's for those of you who don't know, setback is what's left in the still after you finish the distillation. And we collect that in a tank and then use that to go in there. So what that does, that liquid coming out of the still is a fairly low pH, and so that's gonna drop the pH of that mash down to somewhere around 4.5 to 5 pH, and that's a pretty acidic mixture. That's, you know, then you don't have to worry about microbial growth for the most part, other than the ones we want, you know, the bacteria and the yeast that are part of the process that we want. But I just say it's kind of interesting because my previous life, I worked with industry and I worked in manufacturing and as a process engineer kind of person who really the focus was how to control the variables in a process. And when I came into distilling, I realized, boy, there's just a whole shitload of variables in this process that you really don't have much control over. Distilleries talk like they do, and I'd say, well, you know, you don't have much control. Even if you grow your own grain, you don't have control completely over that. And if you're open fermenting, you're inviting other yeasts and microbes to join in that party. And
yeah, we invite lactose in our corn all the time.
Yeah,
and leave it open and let it get infected, you know.
If you're using a pot still, you understand that's highly variable, and depending on how you set it up and run it, you're going to get something different. And
it's even if you run it the same 10 times in a row, you're going to have 10 different outcomes, you know.
Right.
Never expect the same thing twice.
Right.
Similar, but never exactly the same.
What size still are you guys running there?
Well, that's a lesson learned too. So our stills are basically repurposed stainless tanks that I am able to acquire for a good price. And then we build the stills ourselves based on you know, what I learned in my garage and all the different modifications I made along the way. And we keep them pretty simple, you know. There's as many ways to configure a still as there are people distilling. And
you're right.
And there's no right or wrong way. The question I would ask is, what are you trying to make? Are you trying to make a neutral spirit? Well, then you're going to go this route. Are you trying to make a flavorful spirit? Then you're going to kind of go this route.
It's like fixing a car, man. There's a tool for every job.
Exactly.
And if you got the right tool for that job, it's going to make your job a whole lot easier than trying to use a hammer and a screwdriver.
Yeah. Pliers for everything.
Yes. That's me. Give me the vice grips and a hammer.
So, you know, the world. Channel hammers.
Sean don't have any.
What I finally came to in the garage was, you know, the basic still, the pot, and then we use two doublers or thumpers or retorts or whatever language you want to use. And then the spirit, you know, the final spirit doesn't have to be redistilled. It's ready to go. You can put it straight into a barrel. And that, you know, that just saves the trouble of, well, I got to run, you know, X number of stripping runs to do a finishing run and blah, blah, blah.
That's all time and money.
I've done it both ways. And it's not that one's better than the other. One is, I mean, what we're doing, there's trade-offs. It might take a little longer to get it heated up and started and running. But, you know, at the end of the run, you've got something that you can put directly. Well, not directly. You have to, maybe you have to proof it down to the barrel entry proof. But in any case, you know, you don't have to mess around with it again. So
I have a quick question. Do you have a go-to proof point that you like to put it in the barrel, or have you tried that all over the place? Is there a certain spot you like to put it in at?
So, Joey, what I can tell you is that everything that you consider has a trade-off, has a plus and minuses, has something on the other side of it. And when you look at barrel entry proof, and I did all this experimentation in my garage as well. So, because that was one of the things that, you know, there's a lot of debate over what is the best. And so on what you're putting into the barrel is essentially two solvents. You've got alcohol, which is a solvent. You've got water, which is a solvent. Those two, they do different things in the barrel. They pull different things out of the wood. And so in my experimentation, I felt like somewhere in the vicinity of 115 as a barrel entry proof produced the best result overall. You need to have, so the answer is you need to have a high enough alcohol concentration that's going to interact and break down the wood fibers and release the vanillins, you know, from the lignins in the wood. A somewhat lower barrel entry proof is going to give you a softer, gentler product overall, but it might take longer to get there in the barrel. That's kind of the trade-off, right? Higher proof might get you there faster, but then you might get some harsh or astringent things from the barrel. So what I did is I thought, well, and my thinking was, why does the government limit the barrel entry proof to 125 max? You know, it's got to be some conspiracy. You know, they're trying to protect somebody's job or some damn thing. And so I did experiments at basically 10 proof increments, starting at 90 to 100, 110, 120, 130, 140, and so on. And I found out, you know, the higher proofs, to me, this is just my opinion, you know, you get harshness if you go too high. It just gets unpleasant. Mm-hmm. Now, some people might like that, you know, but for me, for my taste preference, you know, 115 was kind of the sweet spot where you got that balance between the amount of time and the overall end result. So on our most of our stuff, we're going in theoretically at 120, but you guys know if you run a pot still, the end result isn't always over 120.
Yeah.
You know, how much tails did you put back in? How long did you run it into the tails? Yeah. You know, all those different variables.
How much boards and heads did you toss?
Yeah.
What was your potential? What was your gravity? What's the humidity, the barometric pressure, you know? Was your wife mad at you that morning? Everything makes a difference.
You know? Is it Monday where everything's going to go fucking off the rails?
You just never know, man. That's for sure.
So, you know, some days you go in, you measure it, and you go, well, crap, it's already at 110. What are you going to do? Well, put it in the barrel. It's not going to be bad.
It'll be all right.
And so that's, you know, that's kind of the nature of what we do. And from my background, it's kind of strange because you would think I would be super anal about it and every detail and stuff. I'm like, no, look, I did the experiments in my garage to say somewhat lower barrel entry proof, you get quite nice product. It might take a little bit longer to get there, but it's going to turn out fine.
Worth the wait.
You know, we're not in a hurry. I don't have to worry about releasing it at X age or any of that. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. What size barrels do you age in?
Well, I did all that experimentation too to try to find out, you know, does a small barrel age more quickly and so forth. And the answer is maybe a little. But so I bought one time, I bought 14 25-gallon barrels just to see if smaller barrels work faster. Well, hell, the 25-gallon barrel at the time was $270, and a 53-gallon barrel is like $225.
It's insane. You know, even used barrels, you could buy a 53 for half the price you could buy a 10-gallon for.
Right. And so I, you know, I tried it, and I thought, okay, I couldn't say necessarily that the smaller barrel did a good job quicker. I just couldn't justify that additional cost. And so right, you know, for the last 7 or 8 years, we've used strictly 53s.
So you was talking about those big tanks that you converted over. What are you using to heat them with? Are you going electric, flame? Did you build jackets around them?
The stills?
Yes.
They got direct flame on the bottom.
Hey, my man.
What gallons size did you say they was?
That's a lesson I learned. You know, I thought somehow I missed the engineering part of it where a bigger is better. And so I got this 800-gallon stainless steel tank that came out of a DeKuyper plant up in Cincinnati. And I got an excellent deal on it. I thought, well, hell, if I put 500 gallons of mash in that sucker, I'll make a barrel a day, you know. That was how the math worked in my head. It takes a lot longer to heat up 500 gallons. So where we've settled now is our stills, they'll hold more, but typically what I want to do is I want to load them with 100 or 125 gallons. And that gives you, well, the stills are still going right now, which is why I have the cool background with the grand piano in it, which I don't know.
I thought you was going to play for us.
Yeah. My kids can play, but I can't. But no, I mean, you know, when I had that still and I put, you know, several hundred gallons in it, and it would just take forever. And so we'd end up running it for 2 days in a row, you know, and we don't have around the clock. We're not an around the clock shift. And so,
yeah,
that
makes sense. You know, it could take time. Like, we've done in shifts before, like, all right, you fired up at 5 a.m. I'll be over at noon.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's my feeling is, so the stills I have now, typically I put either 100 or 125 gallons in them, and you're better off to have four 125 gallon stills than, you know, one 500 gallon still, just because of the length of time it takes to run.
Well, that, if you have any mistakes or hiccups on the way, you know, it's better to lose out on 100 gallons of mash than 500. Or,
well, there's that too. Yeah, yeah. There's that. So I found a bunch of beer fermentation tanks that I got, six of them for like $2,000. And they'll hold 125 gallons easily. They'd hold more, but like I said, it just makes a longer day. And yes. So we built all our stills, and I taught the other guys how to TIG weld. And so now, you know, everybody's kind of built a still. And do-it-yourself shop.
Would you like to share the story of how your OCD premium came about?
Yeah, I saw Tim asking that question.
Yep.
So, as you guys know, I mean, when you're learning something on your own, we say that the learning curve is kind of like a hockey stick. And I think, you know, there's a lot of advantage for us in the fact that we're self-taught. You know, none of us worked at any other distilleries. What we figured out how to do was through our own, you know, experimentation. And so when it came time to bottle our first barrel, you know, the big dilemma was, how the heck are we going to get it out of the barrel and through filter to get the char out and then into the holding tank for the bottling filler. And, you know, of course, everybody else dumps it out into some kind of container. And I just couldn't see a simple way to, I mean, we could dump it for sure, but then you still got to pump it through the filters to get it into the holding tank. So we're kind of scratching our heads, and John, my right-hand man, his father is standing there looking at it. He says, "Why don't you pressurize the barrel and, you know, push the alcohol out?" And I thought that was a brilliant idea. So I made a little gizmo that we can screw in around the bong, and we pressurized the barrel and we pushed the alcohol out through the filters.
Nice.
And yeah,
bourbon keg.
Yeah, kind of
the bourbon barrel keg.
But the downside is, well, the first time we did it, I put the tube all the way to the bottom, thinking I was going to suck up every drop, right? And then I discovered that you suck up all the char and clog the filters. And so then we said, well, okay, let's try this. Let's shorten the tube. And then that worked, but that leaves something in the barrel. And so I was thinking, what am I going to do with that stuff in the barrel? Well, you know, I always revert back to what I learned in my garage, which I didn't have a filtration system in the garage. I had coffee filters, so if I needed to filter something, I just pour it through a coffee filter.
Yep, a coffee filter and a colander.
I didn't care if it had some char in it, you know. If it had a little char in it, didn't bother me. So, anyway, that's what I decided to do with that little bit that was left in the bottom of that barrel. And as I was pouring that through the coffee filter, I realized, man, that just really tastes good. Or smells good, and then I taste it and it really tastes good. So anyway, long story short, we decided that we should put that back. Good deal, Dan. I'll see you then. We put it back in a barrel, and then we keep going until that barrel's full. Hey, I disappeared. Oh, there I am.
Oh. I thought you were going to play the piano.
Maybe. No, I'm beam me up, Scotty.
So when you proof your different alcohols down, do you have a certain proof in mind, or do you proof based on how it tastes
after aging?
Well, just in general, like, you know, when you're proofing down, do you have certain proofs in mind, or is it or is it just more like flavor, kind of like how you age? You said you age by flavor. Do you do your proofing down by that also?
Yeah. So I'd say it's more, you know, after some period of time, what we started to notice was that the sweet spot for most people, I'm going to say, is between 100 and 110. Okay. And yep. So we don't try to hit any set number. It's more like, so John does a lot of the bottling, and we did a barrel the other day, and you know, he gets it all set up, and then he comes over to me and he says, well, it's already 102.6 coming out of the barrel. And I say, okay, well, then just leave it as is.
Yeah.
Right. Or he'll come and he'll say, well, this one's, you know, 118.5 or whatever. I'll say, well, why don't you try to get it down around 108? And, you know, it for us, again, this is one of the steps that for us is not real scientific. Okay. I mean, so what we do is we pump the barrel into the holding tank, and then you look down in there and you go, oh, that looks like maybe 40 gallons. We don't weigh it. We don't have a specific measure. You kind of eyeball it. And then you go to the proofing calculator and you go, well, I got 40 gallons at 114, and I want to try to get it to 108. So that means I got to put, you know, whatever, 3 gallons of water in it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so you put 2 in it because you don't want to go too low.
Right.
And then you measure it again, and then you make it. Does that, yeah, work? It's sort of like I'm still in my garage.
Understandable. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. You know?
Now, I just bought and have not yet received one of those Anton Parr handheld proofometer
nice.
Things.
One of them big money things?
Yeah. So that we can be a little more scientific on how we do it. Because both of us are getting old and our old eyes, it's hard to read the damn scale on the hydrometer.
Understandable.
So anyway, it, you know, I don't know. It sounds bad, but I'm not all that caught up on trying to do anything a certain way or the same way or whatever, you know. The only expectation I have is that everything that we put in a bottle, we think at least tastes good. Mm-hmm. And the fact of the matter is when people taste it, some people are going to like it. Some people are not. That's just the way it is.
That's how it is with anything and everything somebody makes.
Yeah.
It ain't got to be for everybody, but it's going to be for somebody. So.
Especially the person that's making it, because they're going to make it how they like it generally.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, I did have, you had Pat Heist on your show, and it was Pat's recommendation. I met him, you know, years ago, right when I first started, and his recommendation was, well, you might as well distill something that you like, because there's, you know, and then he said, you know, I'm not worried about selling the first bottle. It's the second and third and, you know, fourth bottles anybody will maybe try something once, but the benefit is, you know, people come into the distillery, they get to taste it first, you know, the only other way, like what Uncle Joey got, is somebody picks it up for him or gifts it to him or something, and then they decide that they like it. But you come to the distillery, you get to taste it, and if you enjoy it, then you can make a decision whether you want to purchase it or not. And so that now that we've been around a while, you know, I think most people know that if they pick up a bottle of OCD at the store somewhere, that they'll probably like it. It might be a little different than the last one that they had, but that they'll like it just the same. So,
Are you in Ohio? Do you sell in Ohio?
We'll start in Ohio on the first day of never.
Man. Sounds like Ohio.
Well,
that's Ohio.
This is what I'll do. I'm going to spread the word and let as many people as I can try this, because this is a really good bottle, and I feel like it needs to be shared and enjoyed by people that enjoy good bourbon. So anybody watching or listening, make the trip to Frankfort and go see Dave down at Glen's Creek and get a bottle, because it's remarkable. It's really good bourbon.
Well, let me just clarify this, because I don't have anything against Ohio. There's two things about Ohio that are problematic for a small distillery. One is you're a pretty populous state. You know, you've got several major metropolitan areas, and you've got a lot of people. And when you're using pot stills like we use, we just can't make enough to supply big markets.
Yep.
And the second thing is you're a control state, and those are especially problematic for small distilleries. And so it's not that I don't want to be in Ohio. It's just that when you look at the situation, I'd say, look, we can't supply states like Illinois, New York, California, Florida. You know, those markets are just too big for what we are.
Ohio don't help, man. They don't want you here. They don't want nobody here.
Yeah.
They just want what they got.
It's nothing personal. It's just the reality of you know what we're doing. We distill, depending on the mash bill, you know, 0.8 to 1 barrel a day. And that's, you know, going to average around 200 bottles, and it just doesn't go very far, and it's not, you know, people don't understand. I said, well, it's not that we don't want to grow. We've grown 500% from when we started. And the issue is, for every barrel you put away, you have to pay for it. You know,
right.
It's not just like, oh, I'm going to start making 20 barrels a day or 100 barrels a day. Well, you know, where are you going to get the money to pay for those barrels?
Yeah, you're paying for those barrels while they're sitting. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not for lack of wanting. It's the growth. Growth has to coincide with revenue, you know, and as the revenue increases, then we can put away more barrels. But even if we, you know, increase 100%, then it's 2 barrels a day. Big deal. I mean, it's just not
right.
You know,
You do what's best. You know, you got your way. And it seems like it's working fantastic. So.
I was about to say that you start increasing in size, what's going to happen?
Well, you guys probably know. I mean, the only way to really get any significant size is use a column still. And really, once you switch over to column still, then your product pretty much is like almost everyone else.
Yep. You're making a vodka.
You're not differentiating yourself
in
the market anymore. So, I mean, we've grown, we've continued to grow. You know, I started with one 45-gallon pot still, and now we have three stills that, like I said, can run 125 gallons. And we're going to add another one this year, and then it becomes, well, then you have to cook more often, and you got to ferment more. I mean, you can't just increase one aspect of the process without
it's everything, you know, and that's time.
So
that's time.
Question: how many gallons do you have fermenting on any given day?
Oh gosh, I think there's 24 I think we got 24 totes. There's so many of them around now. There's 24 totes. Each of them hold 200 gallons. Our ferment, our fermentations tend to be longer than typical. You know, a lot of big distilleries do a 3-day ferment or a 5-day ferment. And I've got some that go almost 20 days sometimes. We just don't try to control that or regulate that. We don't need to, you know. They have to keep everything going according to schedule to feed that still, the continuous still. And so some of our mash bills, and I've kind of figured out a way to put the production together. Some of our mash bills take longer to ferment because there's, you know, there's more food available. Mm-hmm. And some of them, like we have a corn only bourbon, it's 100% corn. That one ferments very quickly. The Cuervito Vivo, the recreation of Old Crow, that one, I have to call it something different now. We're calling it Flipping the Bird. Can't call it Cuervito anymore.
So you got an issue with that?
Yeah, so that one takes longer to ferment, you know, because it's got, you know, more fermentable sugars, and we don't buy yeast, so I don't know when we transfer yeast from one batch to the next. I don't know exactly how many we're transferring. It's, you know, 7 scoops in a bucket, and anybody that knows anything about distilling would come and look at our process and go, what the fuck are these guys doing?
These two right here.
You got to measure with your heart with shit.
Yes. Yeah, so we come in like, bro, I do it just like that. Or I do something similar to that. This is me.
Well, you know, it works. And, you know, if we've done a lot of things. We've explored how to improve the yields and things like that, and we've done pretty well at that. That's part of learning. And when you're learning a particular thing on your own, you don't know all the answers, and you figure it out as you go, and you say, okay, for example, what ratio of water to grain do we need? How many gallons of water per, you know, pound of grain? And, you know, initially I went with mash bills I found out there, and they were all about the same ratio. And so you think, well, that's the proper ratio. And then, you know, after several years, I figure out, well, that's the ratio you need to make it flow through your pumps and your system and your this and that, and we're not doing that. And so, can we lower the liquid ratio, because that's less liquid I have to heat up in the cooker, that's less liquid I have to put in the still. And if I can increase the alcohol percentage, you know, to the liquid, then it's more economical. And so we've gone through a lot of that and found ways to you know, squeeze a little more out. But as you know, when you run a pot still, you've got yield losses. You got direct heat, you can't put the grain in the still, so you got to do a separation process. And
we bought
a wonderful machine that it's called a screw press, and it squeezes the crap out of it, and
nice.
That improved our yield. So, you know, I mean, it's not that we're not finding ways to make it better. It's just that, you know, within the process and, you know, pot stills in general, you're just never going to have significant volume. But I don't know. I think based on what I learned in my garage, it was, you know, when I was distilling in the garage, it was eye-opening to realize that the stuff that we buy in the store that we thought was really good stuff wasn't necessarily, you know, the stuff you can make in a simple little pot still at home can actually be quite a bit better.
You taste and, what love in a product is the difference.
I guess.
You put love in what you're making at home. It's part of you, you know, and it's for you, you know, like if I'm cooking myself a steak on the grill, you know, going a little extra. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like you go to a steakhouse, it's like, ah, here you go. Like, you know, you'll put a little bit of more love into something that's for yourself.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, you know. And I really like when we go to distilleries and they're small distilleries and they're doing, like, I'm going to call home distiller techniques. You know, it makes you feel like it's something that you would produce at home. I really like distilleries like that because it makes me feel like, you know, they're more along the lines of how we would do it.
Yeah, I was watching one of your videos and watching you rip open the bags of TSC corn and dump it in. I was like, hell yeah.
Yeah, well, I finally had to stop using them because during COVID, they were having some serious issues. I was getting 15-20% of the kernels weren't cracked at all, and so the yield just went to pot. And being as they're a corporation, I could never get to the source to say, hey, you know, what do we need to do to get this improved? And since it's basically animal feed, you know, the farmer doesn't care if the kernel's not cracked or not, right. But I sure do. And and so my yield was in the tank. So
do you locally source all your grains now?
Well, the corn is local. The barley, wheat, and rye are coming from a supplier over in Louisville. You know, the barley and the rye for sure are grown up north somewhere, and I don't know exactly where. Those are things, you know. Okay, that's great for your story, your local, and this and that, and something. But does it really affect the quality of the product? I don't think so.
And all about dollars and cents in the end. That's right. Yeah.
Well, not so much, but I mean the supplier that we have over in Louisville. I mean, if I send that guy a message, he responds back. He's very responsive. He takes care of us, even though we're just a small fry, you know, in terms of the business and you know, that kind of stuff matters to me. I try to stay loyal to the people who, you know, have been good to us, and I try to stay loyal and say, well, I'm going to be good to you too, and we'll take care of each other. You know, you do good business for me, I'll try to do the same for you. And I don't chase around, you know, for a few pennies here or there or something. And that's just kind of how I approach that. I had a label salesman early on. I mean, this guy just kept after me. So I finally ordered our first set of labels from him. Never heard from the guy again, you know. And it's like, really? You know, if you want to keep doing business, well, at least say hello every now and then or something, you know. And I was probably Tractor Supply's best customer. You know, I was buying almost 90 tons of corn a year, and probably would be a lot more now. But I just couldn't afford the amount of loss of alcohol was more than the cost of corn. So it just got to the point where I couldn't do that anymore. So.
Well, we've been on here almost an hour. I think we've kept everybody here long enough. David, I got to say,
that's about as quiet as I've ever heard you guys.
Well, hey, when we like to listen, you know.
That's right. Hey, I was absorbing. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. So you're there Monday through Friday every day of the week doing what you do?
We're there 7 days a week. If you come any other day, you'll miss us.
Well, I have a weird work schedule, and I have random days off through the week, but I don't like the cold. So once we get a little warmer weather, I'm going to come pay you a visit, sir.
Well, we will certainly be there. You just reach out and let me know. We'll set up something.
Yeah, nice, I'm sure we'll all make a day trip down there.
Yeah, road trip. Big Easy's good for a road trip.
These I'm down for it. Sean won't come. But
yeah, and listen, anytime you'd like to come back on, you've got rum, you've got other stuff we can talk about on another another adventure.
Love well, you know, this was kind of a quick thing here. I know. I mean, maybe next time I could be able to supply you with some samples that we could try out while we're talking.
My man.
Road trip. But anyway, so David, like, man, I appreciate listening to you speak, man. Your knowledge is unmatched. Keep doing what you're doing. Like Uncle Joey said, if you get down in Frankfort, Kentucky, you got to stop at Glen's Creek Distilling, man. You'll be glad you did.
Just make sure.
Down.
I got to put this out there because, I don't know, sometimes GPS takes people to our next door neighbor, which is Jim Beam, and then they see a sign that says no tours. So just so you know, Jim Beam owns the facilities between us and Castle and Key. And so if you keep going past that toward Frankfort, then you'll find us just after that. It says Old Crow, and, you know, that confuses people because I own the Old Crow Distillery, the actual Old Crow Distillery, but Jim Beam owns the sign. So,
gotcha.
Yeah.
My man. All right, Uncle Joey, Matt, Sean, it's good to see y'all, man.
Yeah. David, thank you. I appreciate you coming on, man. I really do.
Yes, sir.
You're welcome, guys. It's been a pleasure. I appreciate it.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Yes.
Everybody have a great night.
Take care.
I guess we'll be back next week. I won't be here. Y'all have a good night.
Yeah. All right. See ya.
Thanks, David.
All right.